And then we will call the meeting of the House Agriculture Committee to order. This meeting is going to be held in accordance with Rule 10.01. Roll call of the 10D, Mr. Smith.
Chair Sundin.
Here.
Vice Chair Vang.
Present.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson present.
Representative Burkle.
Burkle present.
Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Hansen R.
Hansen R here.
Representative Hansen J.
Hansen J present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert present.
Representative Lewick.
Lewick present.
Representative Miller excused. Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Representative Thompson.
Thompson present.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Smith. Representative Anderson, we have the minutes from the last meeting. Would you care to move the adoption of the minutes for February 9th, 2022?
Yes, I do, Mr. Committee Chairman. I would move the adoption of the minutes.
Thank you. Any questions or corrections from the committee? Seeing none, hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Those opposed say nay. Okay, that motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have a full agenda, but it's all somewhat related. We'll hear about the proposals involving the University of Minnesota Vet Diagnostic Lab, a report on concurrent authority over farmed white-tailed deer, and a bill for live testing of farm survey to address CWD. Because we have a full agenda, members and witnesses, please keep your comments and questions concise. First up, Chair Eklund with House File 2980, a bill to provide funding for the Vet Diagnostic Lab. House File 2980, Eklund, please move your bill and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I move House File 2980 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a supplemental finance bill. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. The Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory is a critical resource for protecting animal and public health. This is especially true now with heightened risks of African swine fever and highly pathogenic avian influenza, in addition to ongoing circulation of SARS-CoV-2 in people and animals. In order to stay prepared for major disease events and serve the livestock and poultry producers, the VDL needs to keep current with equipment needs to fulfill this mission. The funding requested is for equipment to provide new tests, such as the RT quick test for CWD, and to upgrade or replace aging or outdated equipment. This includes some equipment that has been in place since the laboratory was built 30 years ago. The legislature provided needed funding 2 years ago for equipment to automate diagnostic processes to increase testing capacity and improve efficiencies. This funding would also add additional equipment to upgrade the next steps in the process and further expand capacity and flexibility. Mr. Chair and members, I have two people here to testify. I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Okay, I see first up we have Dr. Jerry Torreson. Would you please identify yourself for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Torreson. I'm the director of the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab at the University of Minnesota. It's my pleasure to be with you today. The University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab is a key part of the infrastructure that protects and promotes the health of animals and agriculture in the state. While we serve all animal segments, 97% of our laboratory procedures and 93% of our clinical revenue came from livestock and poultry cases in fiscal year 2021. So this funding is truly directed toward serving the needs of animal agriculture in Minnesota. With two more states reporting cases of highly pathogenic avian influenza today, it reinforces the need for a diagnostic laboratory that is adequately equipped and staffed. We are certainly better prepared now than we were in 2014 because of investments the state has made, and this funding will help sustain that preparedness. The funding will be used to purchase equipment that builds on the investment funded 2 years ago to increase our surge capacity for testing in disease outbreak events and improve our day-to-day operating efficiency. Funds will be used to upgrade aging equipment that waste supplies and reagents, to add new equipment for new tests, such as the RT-Quick test for CWD, and to replace some equipment such as autoclaves from when the laboratory was built 30 years ago, obviously due to be replaced at this point. The equipment requested includes items from all laboratory sections, which will help us retain our laboratory accreditation, as well as provide the types and timing of services our clients demand. A list of the equipment planned for purchase was submitted, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Dr. Turrison. Next up, I see Dave Chrysler. Would you please identify yourself for the record and offer your testimony?
Chair Sundin and members of the committee, my name is David Chrysler. I'm the CEO of the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. We're located in Mankato, Minnesota. I'm here to ask for all of you for your support for House File 2980, and thank you to Representative Eklund for authoring the bill. We've also received permission to share that there is a much longer list of supporters for this bill, including both the Minnesota Farmers Union, Minnesota Farm Bureau, Minnesota Cattlemen's Association, Minnesota Turkey Growers, Minnesota Chicken and Egg, Minnesota Milk, and the two farm credit systems that also serve our state. Disease is a part of raising livestock. No matter the size or the species a farm has, it's just one of those realities of raising animals. But there are a number of key elements of management that farms employ, including biosecurity and testing to prevent and treat diseases. An important part of that infrastructure, just like you heard from Dr. Torreson, is our state's, for our state's livestock farmers, is the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. It's commonly used to test animals or test samples from animals prior to movement, especially breeding stock, and to also monitor the disease status of herds. It's critical, it's also critical in the event of a foreign animal disease in order to react to that, and I'll talk about that in just a little bit. One final thing that we've seen more and more farms do is also utilizing those testing services to help them manage resistance as we look at antimicrobial use, and it's been done very successfully. USDA has been very helpful in putting additional resources into border inspections and also border security, and we appreciate that much. We appreciate that very much. Prevention is our best defense against foreign animal diseases. It is, however, important that we also have publicly available labs for testing and the ability to interpret the test results for the benefit of veterinarians, farmers, and the general public in the case of a zoonotic disease. In the event of a foreign animal disease, the only way to move animals in what would be called a control zone is to test them first. We need the ability for accurate, timely testing capabilities in both normal times and if challenged by a foreign animal disease. Volume or capacity matters, and this new equipment will help us as we look at being able to build that capacity. It's also important for all of you to understand that farms do pay fees for the tests that are run. The lab is the official lab of the Board of Animal Health, and it's also a part of a national system that links labs to USDA. Our ask today is to invest in upgrades of equipment for the VDL. Dr. Torreson has provided the details, and we trust that the investment will make the lab stronger and an even better asset for the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chrysler. We have no others signed up to testify on this bill, but keep in mind that Mary Jo Forbord submitted written testimony for your perusal. Any questions of the witnesses or the author? I see a hand up. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chrysler, good to see you, and hope you do well in your retirement upcoming, but don't go quite yet. My question is, do you and the all the affiliated groups that support the expansion of the FDL and the upgrades, do they support RT-Quick capacity for measuring for chronic wasting disease?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we don't necessarily have a specific, you know, either support or lack of support for that technology. We do, though, understand that it's important to be able to prepare for things that would come forward. And we also realize that, You know, the lab not only does livestock, but also does some other things. And so to have a complete complement of, you know, of lab equipment is something that's important.
Okay, Chair Hansen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lewick, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I believe we've got a couple folks from the DNR on, and my question would be directed to them specifically. As we see the potential return of avian high path working its way from the east to west, are we set up to do really aggressive testing of the wild birds, because it would appear that that's the vector right now in that area, and are we plugged into, for example, the veterinary lab to be able to deal with what may be a lot of samples from wild birds, just trying to repeat what we learned the hard way in 2015 about how easy that stuff is transmitted through the wild bird population. I think we got Dr. Karsten and maybe Dave Ohlfeldt were on here. They may be able to shed a little light on that.
Do we have any volunteers from the DNR to help us out? Please identify yourself if so.
Mr. Chair, members, this is Dr. Michelle Carstensen with Minnesota DNR. Is my audio coming in okay?
Perfectly. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lewick, for the question. Yes, we are currently in the process of preparing for participation in the national program for high-path AI surveillance in wild birds. USDA just announced that on Friday that we'll be revisiting wild bird surveillance across, I think, 29 states, in both Mississippi and Flyway included. So we're still waiting to hear what exactly those sampling goals will be, which species. Typically, it's heavy in dabbler ducks, and the timeline and watershed goals specifically. So we'll be working with USDA for that. Those samples tend to go to the USDA labs. Usually it's either USGS lab at the National Wildlife Health Center in Madison or to Colorado with that program. But we also will be increasing our vigilance for any sick bird surveillance and mortality events. And we do submit those to the diagnostic lab, to Dr. Torreson's crew, as those reports come in. So we are prepared to respond to those reports when they come in and submit samples appropriately.
Okay. Thank you. Do you have a follow-up?
No, I appreciate that. And, you know, obviously, just a reminder, in 2015, our labs were overran across the country, particularly in the Midwest, with the level of testing we had to do. So, that's more than on the, just on the radar screen. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Anderson, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And my question is to be directed to the bill author, Chair Ekman. Chair, I support your bill. I think I signed on to it and believe that this is a necessary improvement to the lab, at the equipment at the lab. But I'm just curious, you know, this was not part of the supplemental budget request given to us by the DNR of some $62 million. And it appears that you have a lot of supporters lined up to support the bill. So there's been a lot of work put into this. So just kind of curious why this was not part of the governor's budget, the supplemental budget. And I think a lot of us feel that it would be worthwhile to be in that budget. If I could get your thoughts on that, please.
Chair Ekman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Anderson. I have no idea why it isn't part of the supplemental budget. I agree with you, it should be. And I think this is an example of the direction we need to go, and I will advocate with Governor Staff that it needs to be part of the budget moving forward.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, any follow-up on this?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Burkle, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I've got just a couple questions, and Representative Lewick kind of alluded to most of what I was thinking. Having been through the event in 2015 and watching what's happening now in Kentucky and Virginia and around the country, I was curious too about the wild bird testing. First off, is it Dr. Torreson? Is that who from the VDL? I lost the name here.
Dr. Jerry Torreson.
Yeah, that first question would be for him. I'm just curious if you remember back in 15, specifically what kind of volume of testing we had back then, and how would this equipment expand those volumes? My concern is, you know, that the level of testing in the wild bird population back in 2015 was probably lacking to some degree. I know in the commercial industry we were testing extensively, and it overwhelmed the labs. But would this new equipment help you in that effort to expand those volumes, and how much would it expand by?
Dr. Torreson, please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Burkle. Things are pretty different today than they were back 2014, 2015. In large part, again, based on investment that the state made in expanding the Wilmer Poultry Testing Lab, where prior to then, we had no PCR testing capacity out there. Now we have 7 technicians that are trained that can provide testing on site there, in addition to the 17 that we have here. And so we have 2 locations that helps dramatically just in terms of convenience and timing. By the way, we also have 3 trained National Guard technicians that can go out to Wilmer to supplement the staff as needed. And so they're already trained in the high throughput capacity. The total number of tests that were run back in 2015 was about 18,000 over a 5-month period. It peaked out at, I want to say, 300 or so samples on a given day. Happened to be a Saturday, of course, right? And so we've got capacity at both locations to do that on a given day. Actually, in the St. Paul lab, with all the equipment in place, our capacity would be up to 5,000 samples a day, which we don't think we would ever reach with an avian influenza outbreak. Potentially, we might with an African swine fever outbreak, just because of the modeling for the testing that would be required. So, again, I appreciate the question. The state has invested in making sure we're better prepared, and we are.
Thank you. Anything further, Representative Burkle?
I have one more question, if you would, Mr. Chair.
Please.
For someone at the DNR, I'm curious about, I know back in 15, there was questions about the sampling methods and the type of testing that would be done on wild birds. Are we talking, I would assume PCR testing, are we talking actual tracheal swabs, cloacal swabs, or are we just looking at fecal samples and testing those? I'm just curious what kind of testing you'd be doing and how effective the methods would be.
Okay, back to our friends from the DNR.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is Michelle Carstensen again with Minnesota DNR. At this point in time on that federal program that I mentioned was announced by USDA on Friday, they have not specified the sample types and quantities at this point. I would assume it's going to be cloacal swabs again, which was the primary testing method we did in the other years from 2006 through 2017 through the program. But when we do have wild bird mortality events, we tend to submit the whole carcass to the diagnostic lab. So then they might be taking additional tissue samples as well from some of those birds. But at this point, we don't have any knowledge of requests for environmental samples or the fecal sampling that we did in 2015, which is that initial response wave. But I don't know for sure exactly what the USDA ask will be until they provide those specifics to each state.
Any further, Representative Burkle?
No, nothing further. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, thank you. Thanks to the author. Thanks to the testifiers. Thank you for the questions, committee. Chair Eklund, any closing comments before we lay this bill over?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I think this bill shows that not only is our veterinary diagnostic lab thinking well into the future and what they need to be do, but I think they're also showing the tremendous partnership we have with our meat producers. So I ask for your support moving forward, Mr. Chair.
With that, members, House File 2980 is laid over. Thank you. Next up, we have the concurrent authority report on farmed white-tailed deer. We've got a few minutes blocked out for this. This presentation is a presentation on a legislatively mandated report on concurrent authority of farmed white-tailed deer. This report mandate was included in the Omnibus Environment Finance Bill. Representative of the Board of Animal Health and the DNR are here to tell us more about it. We have just 20 minutes blocked for the presentation and 10 minutes for questions. So if members still have additional questions after that time, we'll have to follow up after committee. But today we have presenting Dr. Beth Thompson first, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. Dr. Thompson, please.
Mr. Chair, members, Beth Thompson here, and I'm going to allow, Dr. Linda Glazer is going to be sharing her screen, and she's going to be presenting today. Chair Sundin, thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Glazer, then, please.
Chair Sundin and members of the committee, thank you for inviting us here today. My name is Dr. Linda Glazer. I'm a veterinarian and assistant director with the Board of Animal Health. Can everyone see my screen?
Can.
The PowerPoint. Okay. You can see it, correct?
I can.
Okay, thank you. So concurrent authority of farmed white-tailed deer. Great. Let me just get to... So accomplishments today for concurrent authority. We're working with the passage of the legislation July 1. We have been working with the Department of Natural Resources on co-inspections of white-tailed deer farms. That means our regulatory field staff that normally inspect these farmed white-tailed deer servant operations annually. We're working with the DNR staff that were designated to go on these inspections together and to conduct them jointly. We have gone to routine joint agency meetings, sort of weekly meetings that we're holding now with DNR staff working on concurrent authority and the members at the board that are to kind of exchange information, keep each other updated. We provide sort of information and training as needed for DNR to get them up to speed on the various programs or components of the farmed white-tailed deer program. And then we're communicating concurrent authority to our stakeholders as well. We have migrated to a shared database for farmed white-tailed deer with the intense regulations for farm servants. We also have to keep, fairly robust records to track these herds. And we have gone to using a database that is sort of a copy of the one that the Board of Animal Health uses for all its livestock data entry. And we migrated the information on the farmed white-tailed deer to this separate database, and the DNR and both Board of Animal Health staff now can share this system as of February 1st for recording and tracking all the information on farmed white-tailed deer. And then we've also authorized DNR staff to collect samples for chronic wasting disease testing. So some of the challenges related to concurrent authority, certainly implementing concurrent authority and sort of clarifying what our roles and responsibilities are. Up to this point, it's sort of been getting DNR staff up to speed on the programs, providing information and training as needed. And then we need to start moving forward to determining, each of our roles in the system. And we want to, how do we coordinate the use of authority? And the example would be the DNR stop movement order. The board was notified just the evening before that stop movement order was put place in the state register. Challenges, record keeping, creating DNR access to the board database. We've, accomplished what I think will be a great system going forward with sharing a database, and that was active February 1st. And then determining rulemaking for each agency going forward. As you are aware, the board was in a rulemaking process for proposing amendments for the farm servant rules, which was started in June 2020. We're approximately a year into the process and then paused that rulemaking process with the change to the from the legislature for concurrent authority. And we need to start moving forward again on that those rule changes, because they're critical for providing improved oversight of all farm servants. And then the Board of Staff workload has increased. We needed to provide information regularly to the DNR, kind of get them trained in on the program components, and you know, we're sharing conducting servant activities. So those are some of the challenges that we've seen from the board. Just a comment on the DNR movement ban that was placed on October 11th on all farmed white-tailed deer, which did not allow any import of farmed white-tailed deer and no intrastate movement of farmed white-tailed deer, no movement within the state. It did allow for export of farmed white-tailed deer to other states. And then that movement was then based on concern for a CWD-infected herd in Wisconsin, and the animals that were moved out of that herd potentially to other states. And so I just want to talk briefly on the traceability system related to farmed white-tailed deer that we have in place currently. It is similar to how we manage livestock movement, all types of livestock movements. And to move animals interstate between states, you need to have official identification. And live servants imported into Minnesota must also have a certificate of veterinary inspection, meaning a veterinarian has to evaluate those animals and attest to the health of the animals that are coming into the state. And they also have to meet specific requirements of the herd status and be eligible to move animals out of, you know, the herd has to be eligible to move animals into Minnesota. In other words, they cannot be a CWD infected or exposed farm servant herd in another state. And they must have status as meeting, they meet the requirements for monitoring for CWD and also testing for bovine tuberculosis. And so official ID is unique within to each animal within the United States. And these are just some examples of the types of tags that we that can be used on farm servants. And they are very similar and really the same tags that are used certainly on cattle that move interstate as well. So anyway, we also want to talk about our ongoing, you know, cooperation, coordination with University of Minnesota research staff, the team there at the College of Veterinary Medicine. We're working with Scott Wells currently on two research projects that were funded through USDA cooperative agreements. And we're working on developing a risk assessment for farm servant producers to identify risks in their herd to exposure to CWD. And then also the university will be developing online training modules to educate farm servant producers on biosecurity, trying to reduce this risk. And we work with Dr. Peter Larson and his team at MinPro regarding RT-QIC, and certainly work with him and USDA when we find CWD infected herds that are being depopulated through federal indemnity to alert them to the fact and work with USDA to be able to collect tissues from those animals for testing using RT-QIC and developing their testing methods. So going forward, we're working now with the DNR and refining our roles and the responsibilities of each agency. In other words, we don't want to duplicate each other's efforts or you know, we want to be efficient and use our funds from the state efficiently. And so identify the roles and responsibilities that best fit with each agency and sort of divide up those responsibilities in the program. Once we outline that, we'll be renewing the memorandum of understanding and updating it to incorporate those roles and responsibilities identified and assigned to each agency within that MOU. And we're going to be continuing to pursue rulemaking for all other servants the boards oversees. So all the non-farmed white-tailed deer herds will be continuing rulemaking on that side. And then we'll continue to work with researchers on chronic wasting disease and certainly adapt to any new legislation that might be produced this session. And that's a very quick overview. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Glazer. Next testifier would be Captain Robert Gorecki from the DNR. Captain Gorecki, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good afternoon. Thank you for having us. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, I'm just going to pull up my screen here. All right, Can you guys see the PowerPoint on the screen?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you. Like I said, good afternoon. I'm Captain Robert Brecky with DNR Enforcement Division. I was one of the co-managers for the DNR coordinating this project since the concurrent authority started approximately July 1st of last year in conjunction with our Wildlife Division. Well, real brief overview of the concurrent authority, what our plan was, what the report summaries were, recommendations thereof, and then we'll take questions at the end. So the DNR created a project plan to analyze the deer farming industry in response to the legislature's July 1st request to do concurrent authority and then come back to them with findings of that report. And just to give you some context, as of July 1st, there was approximately 176 white-tailed deer farms across the state of Minnesota. There's currently less than 150 white-tailed deer farms in the state of Minnesota. DNR identified a six-month goal of inspecting a minimum of 40 white-tailed deer farms during that time to get a better handle on how the process worked, any potential issues or deficiencies, concerns. We had established coordinated efforts with the Board of Animal Health. We had numerous meetings. We learned about the process, the records management process, as Dr. Glazier spoke to earlier. Identified biosecurity PPE in order to protect both the farms and ourselves and the wild herds from any exposure from interacting with these farms. And then we also identified additional staff from the DNR that would be working with the board in this concurrent authority project. So moving forward, the process, we created a deer farm DNR inspection form, which was really important. As Dr. Glazier stated, we now have access to their Core One system effective February 1st. During this time, we did not have that, so we needed to have a method to collect that data. We worked with Trace First to create, like Dr. Glazier said, a copy and paste, if you will, of white-tailed deer data into a separate system so that the DNR didn't need to have access to the Board of Animal Health's full system. We trained additional wildlife and enforcement staff in doing white-tailed deer farm inspections, and we also participated in the indemnification and depopulating process for white-tailed deer farms that were exposed to CWD during this time. So process to date, the DNR is continuing to train new staff. As Dr. Glazier explained, we're working on creating a new MOU with future responsibilities, which includes having staff to enter assist, information into the Core One system. We're continuing to do white-tailed deer farm inspections until new direction is given by the legislature. And we're continuing to train other staff for future responsibilities under the new MOU. While this was going on, we're all well familiar with the Wisconsin deer farm that tested positive for CWD that had sold deer to seven different states across 40 different facilities, including to facilities here in the state of Minnesota. The DNR was made aware of this on September 26th. From there, the Board of Animal Health confirmed to us that there was three Minnesota deer farms that had received deer directly from this contaminated or exposed CWD positive farm. So there was also concerns by the DNR that there was approximately 380 deer remained that were shipped across the state as well as outstate of these other six states, that those deer could have potential risk to the state of Minnesota. So from our discussions with the Senate Ag Committee yesterday, we wanted to expand a little bit about the those concerns. I'm not gonna read this whole slide for you, but just to give you a brief overview, there was four deer tested positive on the farm itself at this time when we found out about the CWD positive farm on September 26th. There was three additional CWD positive deer that were sold to other producers within the state of Minnesota. So as of that time, there was seven positive CWD deer. There was one deer still alive in the state of Minnesota that the Board of Animal Health did not know the CWD status of until November 4th, while we were still within our temporary movement restrictions. This report was put together by the Wisconsin's equivalent of Board of Animal Health, and we received that as well as the Board of Animal Health received that report on October 28th of 2021. And as you can see here, deer were shipped in these various different states, and approximately 77% of the deer total that were sold were untested and were still potential risk to the state of Minnesota. So after reaching out to these states, we did determine that a lot of these other states do not have the robust testing requirements the state of Minnesota does, and that we were just not going to find out the test results on a lot of these deer. Some states do a little better job. Some states do not require testing, like the state of Oklahoma for hunt facilities. They don't require testing. And why this is important if they're going to kill the deer is those deer are passing through other herds with other deer that are not associated with that Wisconsin deer farm. And so if they have eating out of the same bucket, if you will, for feed, and they have that contact with that CWD positive deer that we have no test for, we don't know if those deer have been exposed or not. And having a veterinary certification of the deer being in good health is important. But when these deer oftentimes do not develop symptoms for multiple years, that does become problematic for protecting our state deer as well as the white-tailed deer that are wild in our state. And just to give you also a little bit better understanding, in the last 2.5 years, the state of Minnesota has imported 220 cervids into the state of Minnesota from other states, including these states that had deer that were potentially exposed that we'll never know the results for. Unfortunately, a lot of these deer testing were going to be dead ends because they don't require testing. So as of December 6th, the DNR did lift the ban, realizing that there's some things we're just not going to find out about, and we're going to move on to more permanent importation legislation requests. In this slide here, it shows the distribution of CWD as it's known to exist in 28 U.S. states as well as 4 Canadian provinces. Many of the states lack the financial resources to adequately conduct CWD surveillance of wild cervids. And so it varies from state to state on how big or how robust of a system they have. The USDA herd certification program does not guarantee freedom from disease in a herd, only participation in a CWD surveillance. So why is this important? Of the CWD infected herds in the US over the past year, 5 years, excuse me, most of those had achieved the highest level of USDA CWD certification at the time the disease was discovered, meaning they were the highest certification level, but yet they still ended up having CWD in the herds. So due to lack of the valid anti-mortem testing, like we talked about earlier with the previous conversations with the veterinary diagnostic lab, we're often a year or two behind the disease in detection within the wild herds, thus exposing more animals to CWD during that time. So DNR temporary rule stop movement was rescinded to allow for permanent rulemaking process. And that's one of the recommendations that we're going to be moving forward here. You'll see that in a minute. Broaden the language to disallow importation from any state or province where CWD is found in either the wild or farm cervids. So currently, CWD deer farms, or excuse me, CWD restrictions are only for the county that facility is based in. So if you're one county over, you're not going to be prevented or prohibited from exporting deer out of that area. Such was the case like in this Wisconsin deer farm. Restrict interstate movements of deer from all deer herds within CWD management zones as defined by the DNR, unless going direct to slaughter. Very similar along those same lines. So here we are. Now we got to kind of the current and future planning. We've submitted the legislative report on February 1st. We identified and developed statutory and rule changes to better manage CWD. We continue to operate under current legislation until directed otherwise, and continue to work with the board in coordinating our co-authority efforts to maximize efficiency and lean into the strengths of both agencies. Both agencies bring different strengths to the table, and I think that's really important to remember as we move forward. The Board of Animal Health does a lot of great things, and so does the DNR, and if we could really lean into them and try to maximize our efficiency, both for fiscal responsibility and for the risk to the wild deer and the farm deer for CWD and other diseases. So legislative report summary findings. The DNR did 50 white-tailed deer inspections during that six-month time period. Our goal was 40, so we did do more than that with the Board of Animal Health. We identified 17 total violations at 15 different farms of those 50. That's a 30% violation rate. And to me, that was just far too high. And these are violations that both the Board of Animal Health and the DNR agreed were violations. And they've informal action was taken with those, excuse me, back up here. Other interactions that were important to note were 70% of the deer farms were located in areas of good deer conditions, good deer habitat, areas where you typically find deer. And moreover, 44% of the deer farms had direct evidence of close or direct wild deer farm deer contact, whether that's actual observations of wild deer, quote unquote, touching nose to nose through a fence, fighting through a fence. We've seen multiple deer that had injuries sustained from fighting other bucks through the fence, footprints along the fence perimeter line, feces, whatever it may be. Approximately half of those deer farms had that. And 46% of the deer farms fed and or watered their deer within a very close proximity to the fence, which is important to keep in mind, as that's an attractant for those deer to make it more likely that they're going to come closer to not only interact with the deer, but now get food or water that they might not otherwise have access to in the wild. Some of the challenges during this was the inspections. We need to be clear, consistent, and disciplined in the inspection process, and it must be adhered to by inspectors. Our rules are only as good as the people that are enforcing them, and we need to make sure we're consistent to make sure that these rules are being followed across the state, no matter who the inspector is. We need to be consistent with follow through with penalties and violations must be administered, again, clearly and consistently across the state. If you have three violations, do you only give them one? Do you give them two violations? These are the type of conversations that we're having, that we need to be consistent across the state. A new inspection scheduling system must be developed and ensure compliance. Currently, the DNR farm, or excuse me, the whitetail deer farm producer gets to dictate when that inspection is, what works best for them. Well, if you're doing compliance and making sure that that the facility is up to standards, there probably needs to be a review of how that inspection is scheduled. Review of current fencing, tagging, and inspection requirements. Are these rules adequate to prevent the spread of CWD? And again, we talked about a 30% violation rate found during those 50-year inspections. And then, of course, streamlining and modernizing of the reporting requirements for producers is needed to keep accurate records. The DNR now currently has access to the Core One record management system, but is there ways to modernize the Core One system for the producers in order to reduce the backlog of inspection reports, annual reports that these producers are submitting at this time? There was many farms that we went to where the producer is supposed to have 14, 13, whatever it is, deer on the facility. We show up, they have 8 or 9, and the records have been submitted, but because of the backlog and records, they're not up to date. So it's very difficult to do inspections when you don't know how many deer are on the farm. Other challenges that we found, you know, in the last 6 months, we've had 8 cervid escape incidents, 7 of which were white-tailed deer during this last 6 months. 4 additional public received farm deer escapes that couldn't be confirmed. These are ones that we receive calls from the public that they see or give us photographs of a deer with an ear tag that we couldn't corroborate where the deer came from. In the past 5 years, there have been 60 escaped cervid incident reports involving 158 cervids across the state. These are farmed deer that are getting outside the fence, which is really the only physical barrier we have to prevent the deer from interacting. In the past 10 years, there have been 159 escaped cervid incidents or reported incidents across the state. And again, keeping in mind, we have approximately 150 white-tailed deer farms as of right now in the state of Minnesota, and we had 8 escapes in the last 6 months. So we're also working on developing a more effective reporting, response, and recovery dispatching system. This picture here is of a deer that a Minnesota conservation officer dispatched in the last 6 months of an escaped farmed white-tailed deer. Conservation officers have also notified deer farmers of escaped deer and helped them recover those deer. So we're trying to help the farmer as well as help the white-tailed deer wild population to protect both species here. And that is one of the big challenges that we're looking at. Communication, as Dr. Glazier spoke, you know, the Board of Animal Health and the DNR need to continue to improve communication between the organizations. We also need to improve education and communication with producers. Producers informed us, we actually had 2 producers inform us that they would not allow DNR to inspect their facilities during that 6-month process. And we also need to continue to educate and inform the public, hunter, user groups, other government agencies, tribal governments on CWD issues, and work with both agencies to ensure consistent messaging when appropriate.
Hey, thank you, Captain Gorecki. Are you close to the finish? I
have one more slide, if that's acceptable.
Thank you.
All right. So we have 6 current rule recommendations that we feel that are in critical need to get done as soon. Those 6 are this last slide I have. Essentially change the amount of time to correct a deficiency from 45 to 14 days when fence deficiencies are identified. Currently, the rule is 45 days. We think 14 days would be more appropriate and reduce the risk to the wild deer. Require all white-tailed deer to be officially tagged within 14 days of birth. Currently, they're not required until October 31st. This can help with escapes and identification. Require all white-tailed deer facilities to be physically inspected every 2 years versus the current 3-year requirement. This is the only time where deer's ear tag numbers, their official ID, are manually read or physically read to ensure that it's the proper deer. Finally, proposed importation ban of white-tailed deer from any state or province, as I discussed, who currently has CWD in farmed white-tailed deer or in the wild. Movement of deer restricted if a producer fails to test. If they're not testing for CWD, we don't think they should be allowed to move deer. And then finally, require testing of all farmed white-tailed deer older than 6 months and reporting of the death within 7 days. Currently, deer over 12 months need to be tested, and within 14 days, the death report needs to be submitted. So these are the six most time-pressing recommendations that the board and the DNR came with out of this legislative audit report. That was a quick rundown summary. Is there any questions from the group?
We'll deal with questions at the very end. We have Dr. Michelle Carstensen from the DNR. Dr. Carstensen.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I believe I covered Dr. Carstensen's portion. Trying to speed things along.
Thank you very much. We've got about 15 minutes for just a few, 10 to 15 minutes for questions here. So any questions from the committee, please? Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank the DNR for their presentation. I know that they had quite some grilling over in the other body, but what they've documented here is really a sad case of inaction. I can't help but think, listening to this, what if we had passed double fencing 3 or 4 years ago? What if we had had the redundant gates a few years ago? What if we had had the readable ear tags? I'm stunned that even now, 5 years after this crisis, we're still finding deer outside of the fence with ear tags. That's not an evolutionary trait. Deer do not grow up with plastic in their ear. It's put there. So it's just kind of sad that we're continuing to be in this situation. Not surprising, but sad. You know, if I'm speeding down the road and I get pulled over by a state trooper, I don't get to choose who can pull me over. I don't get to choose, I don't want the state trooper to pull me over. I'd rather have the county sheriff or the police pull me over. So, I think both agencies are in a very difficult spot because they have to share this responsibility. And I think we were correct last year, and we're still correct. The responsibility needs to be one, and it needs to be with the Department of Natural Resources.
Good. Thank you, Chair Hansen. We've got just a few minutes left here, so we've got three other questions. If you can keep it to a minute or so, I'd really appreciate that. Chair Eklund, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this question would probably be for Dr. Glazer. This came out of the DNR report. Number one, 30% violation rate. Is that common when any kind of agricultural operation is inspected? And then number two, do you think this co-management is going to work? Because if a producer can pick when their farm can be inspected, it seems like it's a process that's doomed to fail. That'll be it for my questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Dr. Glazer, please, comments?
Chair Sundin and Representative Eklund, thank you for the questions. The primary livestock group that we do inspections on is farm servants, with the exception of poultry hatcheries on an annual basis. And so we really do not have annual inspections of other livestock species that I can reference as far as a violation rate or anything. So, and I tell people too that our farm servants are the most intensely regulated with the Board of Animal Health. So we have record keeping requirements, timelines for submissions that no other livestock group has, and these are all considered violations. So we do have, and paying fees, and so we do have record keeping violations as well as the inspection violations. So, the 30% kind of includes all of those type of violations, and we typically will issue the violation, give the producer a timeline to complete them, and then, you know, increase, you know, steps to go from there with penalties, and then addressing the, you know, any remedies, as well as going to the court. So right now I don't have any other inspection data from other programs. And the only other one we have is poultry hatcheries, and I can certainly find that if you like. The other one question you had, Representative Eklund, was, will concurrent authority work? And certainly we've outlined the challenges we've had. I think it is, you know, we have two agencies interpreting how we both oversee the same rules and the same group of animals. And so we are certainly working to better, you know, define this. We've been in a training, you know, let's say crawling, walking phase, as Captain Grecki would state, and we need to start apportioning out the duties and each sort of taking sort of our roles and responsibilities and then working together with that. So certainly we can move forward with concurrent authority. But as you know, we've outlined some of the challenges that we've had to this point, as was requested by the legislature. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Glazer. We have three more questions, I'm assuming three more answers. If we can keep them very concise so we stay on schedule, I'd appreciate that. Representative Lewick with a quick question. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually got two questions. I hope we've got time to explore two subjects. One is, can both the DNR and the Board of Animal Health give us a reasonable expectation of where we're at on the rulemaking process that we derailed a year ago? You know, it seems like we're busy trying to get to know each other. So that's an important thing that needs to provide everybody in the field and the producers with, okay, here are the real rules. So can both agencies give me a perspective on where we're at? And I certainly have a follow-up.
Okay. Who'd care to take that one?
Chair Sandine and Representative Lewitt, I can follow up with the Board of Animal Health. We are proceeding with the non-whitetail deer farm servid rules. We have a draft that we have currently at the revisor's office, and once that draft is returned, we will put that out for public comment again. We are still on a pause because as far as farmed whitetail deer, we understand you know, the rulemaking authority has to include both the DNR and the Board of Animal Health, and to this point, the DNR has not been ready to move forward with rulemaking on farmed whitetail deer, as my understanding. Thank you.
Follow up, Representative Lewis, please.
Well, I certainly would ask an explanation from the DNR if we've got. You know, it looks like it's a partnership here. So, what is left for the DNR to do to at least pursue some of these things? You know, sometimes if you want to bite the whole thing and swallow it, you'll choke. We should be able to get the low-hanging fruit down and in place very quickly. So I you know, maybe the DNR can enlighten us on what things are holding you back right now from moving forward on this.
Can we get a quick answer from the DNR?
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner of DNR.
Thank you,
Bob Meyer. I'll be very brief. Lieutenant or Captain Grecki did a good job outlining our recommendations in the report. Fencing, ear tagging, testing of animals, all of those things are in statute and rule. We need to get the statute amended so we can correct them in rule. So we look forward to working with you this session and moving on to a rulemaking procedure after the bill is enacted into law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next up, we have Representative Anderson, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Quick question. You know, to me, co-authority means a shared responsibility. And I think there was some testimony from the DNR that they thought Chapter 84 gave them additional authority. But if Captain Grecki or Mr. Meyer could explain the rationale for giving the Board of Animal Health about a day's notice when they put in that stop the movement edict back in October. To me, if nothing else, it was kind of a public relations black eye in not having the shared authority. So what was the reasoning behind that, and why was it seemed to be kind of a surprise announcement?
That's up for grabs.
Mr. Chairman, members, again, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner.
Bob Meyer, please.
This was our third stop movement order we've enacted over the past couple of years. We followed the same procedure each time, notifying the Department of Agriculture and the Board of Animal Health the day before the rule went into place. So I recognize the concern. We're working on communication issues moving forward, but that's the reason for that interaction at that point in time, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Thank you for the response. Representative Burkle, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Technically, Representative Anderson kind of went where I was going. I was curious about the stop movement ban and the effect it had on deer farmers in my district in particular, and the revenue loss to them. I can maybe wait a little bit till maybe after the next testifiers, but I would like to understand a little deeper how this co-authority works. I just don't see it working. And maybe Dr. Glazer or Commissioner Meyer could give me some idea how they see this going forward. But I just see two separate agencies trying to regulate the same thing. I don't know how this is going to work.
Thank you, Representative Burkle. Would it be acceptable if I direct Dr. Glazer to address you personally?
Please.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thanks for the presentation discussion. The last item on this agenda is Chair Eklund. Again, you have House File 2814 regarding live testing for farm survey day. 2814, Eklund, you want to move your bill and address it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 2814 to be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, Finance and Policy.
Thank you. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. House File 2814 is really a pretty simple bill. We've heard a lot of talk already on chronic waste and disease. I think there's some things that we heard in the past discussion that we can do right away, like, for instance, take a look at double fencing or other matters like that that could fix this right away. We know the technology available to live test animals for chronic waste and disease. As you heard from Dr. Glazer earlier about this test is not yet USDA approved. However, approval is expected in the near future. We go to great lengths and take all precautions in protecting our meat and food supply. And the RT Quick test is one more tool that we have available to protect the industry. There are approximately 3,500 captive whitetail in the state, and this bill appropriates $250,000 to the Department of Natural Resources to live test all captive whitetails in the state. This will tell us if there is or is not a CWD issue in the farm survey in the state. If we find that there is not a CWD problem in our farm survey industry, that would be fine. If we do find problems through the use of this technology, then we would know the areas of the state that need the most attention. Mr. Chair, members, we've been fighting CWD for 5 years. I'd like to get to the bottom of what's going on here. And I think using this RT Quick is the way to go. And our livestock industry has always wanted the latest and greatest in testing, as you saw from the earlier VDL bill that we did. The pork producers are looking for RT Quick themselves. So today, Mr. Chair and members, I have a few testifiers. And then I will stand for questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. To the testifiers, you've got about 2 minutes apiece. Let's be cognizant and courteous of the testifiers that are going to follow you. I would like to hear from everyone and have a few minutes for questions. But at 2:27, we're going to curtail the discussion and take a vote on this bill. First up, we have John Zanmiller. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Zanmiller, and I'm with Bluffland Whitetail Association. I won't go into the problem that we face. We're all keenly aware of the situation with chronic wasting disease on either side of the fence. But I wanted to speak in support on behalf of the members for this bill. This bill will improve monitoring and accountability of servant herds and decrease the needless and devastating spread of chronic wasting disease. This is just one piece of a larger effort that we need to do to combat the disease that could be implemented. Many will question RT-QuIC's validity, but current antemortem testing is also unreliable and unvalidated. Numerous peer-reviewed studies have been done or soon will be done on RT-QuIC's effectiveness. USDA validation is widely expected within the next 12 months, and private industry, including Minnesota's own widely known company that produces animal retractants, is using RT-QuIC on their products to ensure that they are not unnecessarily spreading chronic wasting disease. And finally, courts are increasingly recognizing the admissibility and reliability of RT-QuIC. An administrative law hearing was held on November 16th. Barbara Case was the administrative law judge, and if I may read from her findings and order, there is ample material in the record to affect that RT-QuIC is a relatively long-standing, reliable, and generally accepted way for research scientists to test for the CWD prions. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this makes sense. And to echo what Representative Eklund says, once we know the extent of the issue, we can set out a clear plan for addressing it. I appreciate the committee's time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zahnmiller. Next up, we have Dr. Peter Larson from the University of Minnesota. Please identify yourself and offer your testimony.
Chair Sudeen and members of the committee, my name is Peter Larson. I am assistant professor at the University of Minnesota and am co-director of MinPro, the Minnesota Center for Prion Research and Outreach. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. I'm here to testify as to the utility of the RT-QuIC assay for CWD diagnostics. RT-QuIC is a highly sensitive and accurate diagnostic assay for the detection of prions. The test was designed over 10 years ago by researchers focused on developing anti-mortem diagnostics for Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans. Over 300 peer-reviewed scientific publications have been published on RT-QuIC, and the test is now routinely used in research labs for the detection of several prion diseases, including CWD. The performance of RT-QuIC has been extensively examined for a wide variety of tissue types and biological samples. When using tissue samples for the detection of CWD, the RT-QuIC assay generates reliable and reproducible results with low rates of false positives and false negatives. We recently published a peer-reviewed manuscript of DNR co-authors that compared RT-QuIC with traditional ELISA testing for CWD. We found that the accuracy of RT-QuIC was in full agreement with the ELISA test and that RT-QuIC is likely more sensitive than ELISA for CWD. A recent publication from Michigan also showed that RT-QuIC was comparable to ELISA and IHC testing for CWD, leaving the authors to conclude that the method would be useful for future CWD surveillance programs. The bottom line is that RT-QuIC is not producing spurious or non-reproducible results when examining cervid tissues. Our MinPro research laboratory has performed thousands of RT-QuIC reactions in a variety of tissue types, and our assessment of the test is consistent with that of other research labs. We believe it will be an important tool for managing CWD. One of the major hurdles for expanding the use of RT-QuIC for CWD surveillance was that the reagents needed to perform the assay were not widely available. 3 years ago, this was identified as a significant limitation, slowing USDA validation process and preventing the establishment of an RT-QuIC surveillance network. MinPro is now producing large quantities of the essential ingredient for RT-QuIC, and we are supplying this ingredient to the USDA for free to facilitate their validation process. The fact that the USDA is in the process of validating RT-QuIC should not be perceived as a weakness of the test itself. Any diagnostic test used for official regulatory purposes must be subjected to an intensive assessment by regulatory officials and scientists. This process takes time, as it should, and is structured to provide a thorough understanding of the accuracy of any new diagnostic test for a national reportable disease. Based on comments made by the USDA at the most recent Board of Animal Health meeting, we fully anticipate RT-QuIC to be validated for live animal testing using rectal biopsies within the next year. We note that Texas has already begun live animal testing using rectal biopsies in the IHC test. Upon completion of the USDA validation process, we anticipate that other states will incorporate RT-QuIC-based live animal testing into their CWD management plans. Considering these observations, our MinPro team recommends the state begin a concerted effort to plan the logistics of incorporating RT-QuIC-based live animal testing into Minnesota's CWD management plan. To conclude, our MinPro research team is in full support of the usage of RT-QuIC for CWD surveillance We are happy to assist the state and the University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory with the development of CWD managed strategies that leverage RTQuick technology. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Larson. Next up, we have Craig N. Engwall, Executive Director of Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. Craig N. Engwall, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I am Craig Engwall. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. MDHA was founded in 1980, and we were comprised of 60 chapters across the state with nearly 20,000 members. Our mission focuses on habitat, education, and advocacy for wild deer. I'm here to testify in support of Representative Eklund's bill, but before we get to the bill itself, I want to highlight some of the existing concerns we have with respect to captive servants and the threat they pose to the wild deer herd. About 4 years ago, the legislative auditor recognized many deficiencies in the servant farm oversight program. Among them, nearly one third of servants were not postmortem tested for CWD as required by law. Many of the concerns raised by the legislative auditor still remain today. Most recently, we point to the situation in Beltrami County where a servant farmer moved animals from Winona County over 400 miles to his farm, and some of these deer were CWD positive and infected his herd. That farmer then disposed of carcasses illegally on state land that has potential to expose the wild deer herd to CWD. If CWD becomes widespread in the wild herd, it's not only an economic threat to small towns in Minnesota who depend on deer hunting and other tourist avenues. While the wild deer hunting season is approximately $500 million industry per year, but it's also a great social tradition in Minnesota, and we fear that the movement of animals poses a threat to that tradition. Again, we feel that the movement of captive servants across the state is the greatest risk to our wild deer herd today. So how do you mitigate that risk? Number one, you restrict the movement. I would say it's akin to emerald ash borer in that you want to slow the spread. So to the extent we can limit the movement of deer 400 miles in a day, we're helping to protect our wild deer herd who, you know, wild deer can spread the disease, but they're not moving across the state at that rate. Number two, you can also test animals before they move. And as the speakers have said, until recent times, that was very difficult. But we view RTQuick as a game changer. We think that testing live servants would greatly mitigate the risk of passing CWD from captive servants to the wild deer herd. And to the extent that RTQuick is not USDA certified, we've heard testimony that it should be soon, and that's what it appears will happen. But also, the board has said that they can't rely on RTQuick because of the USDA. And I would just note that our requirement to rely on USDA certification is imposed by the state of Minnesota in Chapter 35. There's no federal supremacy issue here. So that was a decision that the legislature made. It is a current law, but it could be changed by the legislature if the legislature deemed RTQuick to be a reliable test. So again, thank you for the opportunity to testify here in support of Representative Eklund's bill, and I will stand for questions later if there are any. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Engwall. We've repeat performance. Dr. Jerry Torreson, please.
Thank you, Chair Sundin and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Torreson. I'm the director of the University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, as you heard earlier. First, I'd like to reiterate the progress and the promise of the RTQuick test for CWD. Other diagnostic laboratories participating in the USDA validation process have given very positive comments about the performance of the test and the work being done in the MinPro lab to advance the test validation, as Dr. Larson described. But right now I'm here to explain some details about how testing works within the USDA network of laboratories and how the timing of the implementation of the RTQuick test could affect all of our testing for USDA. The University of Minnesota Diagnostic Lab is part of the USDA National Animal Health Laboratory Network, or NALN, comprised of 59 veterinary diagnostic labs across the US, including level one labs in 23 states, including Minnesota. The NALN supports U.S. animal agriculture by developing and increasing the capabilities and capacities of a national veterinary diagnostic lab network to support early detection, rapid response, and appropriate recovery from high consequence animal diseases. Our Minnesota lab tests for 10 of the 14 what we call program diseases, so official tests for official diseases affecting cattle, poultry, pigs, sheep, goats, and fish. Testing for any of these program diseases requires an official, standardized, and approved diagnostic test. As a non-lab, we are limited to using approved, fully validated, and standardized tests for program diseases to ensure ongoing confidence in the results reported from the entire laboratory network, results with international consequences. I asked for guidance from USDA on how we could implement the RT-QuIC test here at our lab by securing a variance from the requirements. I received a letter this morning from the Chief Veterinary Officer of the US, Dr. Rosemary Sifford, indicating that any use of an unofficial test would result in action by USDA to, quote, address what is considered outside the standard expectations of the non, end quote. To paraphrase, any unofficial testing of a program disease, even a test that has been shown to be highly accurate and beneficial, is viewed as a breach of our contract with USDA and threatens our ability to provide testing for all program diseases. We will continue to advocate for rapid validation of and pursue avenues for using the RT-QuIC test at the VDL, but this is the status as of today.
Thank you, Dr. Torreson. Next up, we have Dave Carlson. If the following four testifiers can keep their comments to about a minute, we'll still have a couple minutes for questions. Mr. Dave Carlson from Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Dave Carlson, the president of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. We're an umbrella organization representing groups across the state and advocate for sportsmen and sportswomen's interests in many areas. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 2814. From our perspective, CWD has been an issue of great interest to sportsmen and women, and especially deer hunters, for many years. Deer hunting is a treasured outdoor heritage for many, and the protection of the wild deer herd in Minnesota is of utmost importance. CWD was discovered in Minnesota. There's not been enough of an effort to eradicate the disease and protect our wild deer herd. A report from the Office of Legislative Auditor in 2008 did not shed a bright light on how CWD has been managed and enforced. The case from last summer in Beltrami County was another serious instance of disregard for the rules and just a lack of common sense. Initially, 13 deer were tested positive for CWD. During the investigation, it was discovered that the herd owner dispose infected carcasses on county land. Let me say that again. The herd owner violated quarantine by moving carcasses off of his farm without the Board of Animal Health's permission. And in all, 19 positive deer carcasses were confirmed in the area. The report from the DNR about concurrent management also disclosed a 30% violation percentage-wise. And I will just conclude with this, that this information is alarming to deer hunters, and we demand that information like this leads to better management and enforcement of surveyed farms and herd owners. Deer hunters have loudly called for more legislation to protect our wild deer herd for a long time. And since 2018, those calls have become louder. And although good legislation has been introduced and heard, not much has been passed. House File 2814 is a good bill and a start to provide live testing for farm deer. And that testing is funded. Deer hunters support this legislation and ask for more common sense legislation to protect the wild deer herd of Minnesota and help leave a legacy for the deer hunting tradition in our great state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Next up, we have Tony Kowalis from the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association. Mr. Kowalis, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tony Kowalis, and I'm representing the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association. Just a couple of brief comments on House File 2814, Mr. Chairman. In regards to Section 1, Lines 2.2 to 2.8, We appreciate the language pertaining to soil tests requires a testing method approved by the board. But right now, there is not an approved or validated soil test at either the state or federal level. The second concern is we appear to be singling out just one infectious disease. There are other infectious diseases out there right now, and none of these requirements are in place for those. We're also concerned regarding the county recorder, register of titles, and notice of CWD detection on the property, especially if the herd owner has completed all the land and time requirements. The concern is that landowners on which CWD positive wild cervids are harvested are not required to record with the county recorder or register a notice of previous CWD detection on their property, Mr. Chairman. I understand section 2 is dealing with white-tailed deer, but the concern there is also the same as it is with the soil testing. And as you've heard, there is no state or federal approved live test for CWD. And if we're going to be making regulatory decisions, we should ensure that any testing requirement is validated, scientifically approved, and peer reviewed. Mr. Chairman, I just want to wrap up by saying Dr. Larson has been doing great work, and we elk breeders are very supportive of his work and the move to live testing. But at this stage, nothing has been officially validated or approved on the state or federal level. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Qualis. Next up, we have Dr. Davin Henderson, CWD Evolution LLC. Please identify yourself for the record and continue with your or proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. My name is Davin Henderson. I'm the founder of CWD Evolution, the only private company that does RT quick testing for CWD. We are actually the company that does the testing for the deer urine for the company in your state. So I have 22 peer-reviewed publications using RT-Quick for CWD detection, and we've been working with this for a long time. I'd like to start with a disclosure. My company is in the process of creating a validated test kit for detection of CWD and post-mortem, anti-mortem, and also hunter-submitted samples using a third eyelid with a company, and hopefully to have that approval in the next year. So I'd like to echo the statements that for any reportable disease, I think it's important that we use an approved test for that type of method, just because it needs to be done in a manner with to carefully define the positives, to carefully define the reaction parameters. So I think only using an approved test for that is an important thing moving forward for this committee to consider. I'd also like to mention soil testing. My laboratory, as well as others, have had remarkable challenges in testing soil for chronic wasting disease. And in fact, we moved on to other things such as excreta, like feces, to test for CWD in the environment. Soil is a very complex matrix, and it is not amenable for RT-Quick testing for a handful of reasons. We found both false positive and false negative testing using soil, and we never could define a proper positive or negative control for the soil, especially a negative control. You can't know that a soil sample is negative and be identical to the sample that you're trying to test, just because of the fact that it has to be from a different location. So we found that soil testing to be extremely problematic. And I'd like to be available for questions if possible.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Henderson. Last up, we have Mr. Tim Sprick from the Minnesota Deer Farmers. Mr. Sprick, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Tim Sprick speaking today for the Minnesota Deer Farmers Association. I'm going to edit as I go because some of these areas have been covered. With regard to the soil testing piece, Dr. Henderson covered that very well. This technology is in its infancy, not particularly reliable. And even though Dr. Larson has had some, encouraging results, I think we have to be very cautious when we put an entire industry in the crosshairs based on an unsubstantiated and potentially non-reliable testing. I also want to draw your attention to the comments that Dr. Kurian made earlier with regard to the USDA. The USDA is not approving this test, and they have been very strict in their letter about what the consequences will be if we do move forward in this area. So we want to be very cautious about upstaging the USDA, upstaging the certification and approval process, which leads me also to be very concerned about the implementation date of October of 2022 on this bill. There's no way that we can possibly have a test accredited and approved within the next 1 to 2 years and then stick with that implementation date. It's just not physically possible. Mr. Chair, with regard to the recording deed restrictions in line 2.2 to 2.5, what this does is it really essentially creates a deed restriction and encumbrance on a property. It's based on potentially inaccurate and unproven and unapproved testing. And what it does is it can essentially create a lifetime encumbrance on a property that will travel with that property through time. We have to be very cautious when we do this because these folks deserve to have clear deed when they come to the point where they want to sell their property. Mr. Chair, finally, line 2.11 to 2.16, technology not approved. As we have learned, technology approval is potentially in the future, but not within the time period that it would be required within the parameters of this bill. There are concerns about false positives with the test, and we really have to be very cautious about getting the horse before the cart when it comes to something like this that could potentially affect negatively an entire industry over time. And with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Spreck. We have a few minutes for questions to the author or the testifiers. I see Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things. I'll try to be brief. I think the testimony from Drs. Torreson and Dr. Henderson, to me, puts a short-term kibosh on this bill. This bill is not ready. The test is not ready itself. It's not been approved by USDA. And the other thing, Mr. Chair, you know, this bill originally was going to be laid over for possible inclusion. And as a result, we didn't think there was any urgency in putting amendments forward. And then late after the deadline on Friday, it was announced it was going to be moved on to the Environment Committee. Mr. Chair, I would ask that this bill be laid on the table or laid over to allow more time for us to offer amendments. And also in light of the testimony that that this quick test is not ready yet to be put into effect on October of this year, which would greatly impact the industry, I would ask your indulgence on that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I guess I can apologize for any confusion on that. I don't know the history or background on that, but I can tell you, Representative Anderson, I'm not in the business of short-sheeting you or anyone else on this committee going forward. So thank you for your comments. So they're point taken. Representative Lewitt, please. Down to about 1 minute each.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would echo the concerns of Representative Anderson, and I would ask that the author slow down a little bit here, the bill author, and consider that, particularly with this letter that was issued from Veterinary Services USDA today, that this bill ought to be tabled or at least held over, because you've got some stuff in here that appears to threaten our primary veterinary lab and their credibility. So I would ask that. And Dr. Larson and I, quite some time ago, had some lengthy discussions about the ability to work with the deer farmers and do research projects so we can get this darn thing approved by USDA. We're not going to fix this in the next 6 months. If we don't change our approach here, we keep running around with baseball bats, chasing people down, trying to smash their heads over this. And I'm disappointed because I think this is not going to be helpful to the great work Dr. Larson's done. Now we got USDA came in with a letter today that basically slapped all of us side the head and said, you better settle down and get your act together. Hate to say this, but some of these things take time. And when you're not working with the people that have got the deer inside of the fence like we should be, we're just not making progress. So I would just encourage the bill author and the chair to slow down here, because do not put our veterinary test lab at risk with USDA over something like this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lewick. Representative Burkle has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would definitely reiterate what Representative Lewick just mentioned. Very disappointed to think that our VDO could be put at risk. In fact, I think it's irresponsible to put the important work of the VDF, our VDL mission at risk. And until USDA recognized this BT quick test, I'm just curious if maybe Dr. Glazer at Board of Animal Health or somebody can answer. So without a recognized test, would USDA even indemnify if it was found in a live? How would indemnification be done or handled in light of that?
Dr. Glazer, can you take a minute?
Thank you, Chair Sundin and Representative. The bill as it is written would be problematic for that test result. Now, the outline of the bill says you test it once using RT-Quick, and then you would test it the animal a second time. If it was positive both times, you'd have to put the animal down. There would be no indemnity available for that from the federal government because it's not a recognized test. And you could potentially have that animal be put down and the surveillance test not test positive. And then you've got a real conundrum of the animal's testing, you know, not detected on the surveillance standard to this point, and yet RT-Quick says it's positive. Or then you've got a surveillance positive animal using the immunohistochemistry test, and then the whole herd is now considered CWD infected, and then we would have to request indemnity from USDA at that point as well. So there are a number of issues with testing using RT-Quick and not having it be a test that is recognized by USDA.
Follow-up, Representative Burkle.
Nothing further. I would just say that given what we've heard today, we need to slow down. I think follow the science on this. With that, I'll yield, Chair.
Excuse me, Representative Anderson. I think Peter Larson's got a response.
Chair Sundin, members of the committee. Just following up about comments made about the USDA validation process. To be clear, that's an independent process, not tied with MinPro or any of my work. It's outside of that. We're aware of at least five other state-level diagnostic labs that are already looking towards moving into the RT-Quick space. So again, with the USDA validation, then the first tissue type that they will validate is going to be these rectal biopsies. So that is on the horizon a year from now. And we agree with Dr. Henderson's assessment of soil. That is a troublesome matrix. It just require more time to perfect the protocols for that.
Thank you. We're going to extend our time just a couple of minutes. Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. In light of this recent testimony and some confusion over the progress of this bill, would you consider, if we're going to pass it out of our committee, to amend your motion to do it without a recommendation, without a vote, and just pass it on without that recommendation to the Environment Committee?
Comments from the author on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm fine with Representative Anderson's question. I understand your concern, but gentlemen, slow down. We've been working on this for 5 years. We can't get double fencing. We can't get redundant gates. We've heard nothing but let's get a live test. There's nothing in my bill that says that this test has to go to the veterinary diagnostic lab. Dr. Larson's got it available. Dr. Davin Henderson's got it available if we decide to contract with the test. We've got something that is showing that it'll work, and all we've been getting is a runaround. And if I remind you, a 30% violation rate of our farm whitetail survey is not a good record to be thinking about whether we're going to slow this down or not. If we had something in our swine population, if we had something in our turkey population, if we had something in our cattle population, it would be all hands on deck to make sure that we're addressing this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Eklund, or Chair Eklund. We're at our time, past time right now, so I'm sorry that we can't entertain any more discussion on this. a little help from the committee administrator to modify the motion.
Mr. Chair, I think the appropriate motion would be to move to move without recommendation to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy.
Okay. How about I move or a motion to 2814 be recommended to the to be referred to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, and Policy without recommendation. Would that suffice, or?
That'd be fine.
Okay. Chair Eklund, would you move that House File 2814 be recommended to the to be referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, Finance and Policy without recommendation?
My motion, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We've heard plenty of testimony. Sorry we don't have enough time to continue. This has been a great discussion. That completes our work here today.
Excuse me, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair.
Yeah, take a vote. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for all those that testified. Chair Eklund, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I got a little fired up there, but it has been 5 years that we've been working on this issue, so I ask for members' support.
Okay, thank you. The motion is before us. Mr. Smith, please take the roll.
Chair Sundin?
Aye.
Sundin votes aye. Vice Chair Vang?
Aye.
Vang votes aye. Representative Anderson?
Anderson votes aye.
Anderson votes aye. Representative Burkle?
No.
Burkle votes no. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund votes aye. Representative Hansen R?
Hansen R, aye.
Hansen R, aye. Representative Hansen J?
Hansen J, aye.
Hansen J votes aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Cleavorn votes aye. Representative Lippert?
Lippert, aye.
Lippert votes aye. Representative Lewick?
Lewick votes no.
Lewick votes no. Representative Miller? Excused. Representative Nelson?
Nelson votes no.
Nelson votes no. Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Thompson votes aye. That's 10 ayes and 3 nays. Sorry, 9 ayes and 3 nays.
Okay, there being 9 ayes and 3 nays, the motion prevails, and the House File 2814 is on its way to the Environment Committee. That concludes our agenda for today. Thank you, members, for the constructive discussion. Next meeting is Wednesday. We'll talk with RFA and take up a drought assistance bill. This meeting is adjourned.